There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, it was double duty for Matt Roberts today. He's been up since some unearthly hour, having had the total sum of how much sleep, Matt, last night?
Oh, somewhere between 4 and 5 hours, I would say. Not enough.
Okay. How you feeling?
I feel okay, actually. There was a point during the day where we were just starting the second tie, so sort of technically we were halfway through the day, and it did feel like we were probably going to be there until the small hours. But then the second tie did not go as long as we were expecting. So here we are, recording perhaps at the earliest hour that we have done all week by some miracle.
Yeah, that it is strange, that, isn't it? Because I think the Serbia against Britain tie started about 2.5 to 3 hours later than scheduled, didn't it?
Yeah, which, look, they got lucky, I think, that the play didn't end up finishing at, well, it could have been 2 a.m. You know, we saw in Paris, didn't we, Paris-Bercy a couple of weeks ago, when they have 6 matches scheduled on the court, that they were frequently getting finishes around 2 o'clock in the morning. And we had 6 matches scheduled today from 10 a.m., but with an hour between the two ties. So, you know, if they needed to play all those 6 matches, I think we were looking at a very, very late finish. And I think they've got away with one there because we know that you can't play 6 matches on one court and fit in the same day and finish at a reasonable hour. Like, tennis knows this, and yet it keeps scheduling that. So the fact that we only played 5, you know, only one of them went to 3 sets, you know, and still we finished fairly late. But yeah, the sort of brilliance of Novak Djokovic and Mirmir Kecmanovic meant that we didn't finish really, really late. But yeah, it was a 6:10 start for the second tie rather than 4 p.m., which was sort of stretching the resources of the fan zone. I think they've got this really good fan zone outside the stadium with lots of places to eat and drink, and there's a screen up, and, you know, I don't think they were banking on having so many people in there for so many hours, because people showed up and, you know, that was the only place for them to stay. And I did hear that they started running out of things and, you know, it was pretty cramped in there, but it was also a good space and a good time, and people were enjoying the sun. So I think they just about sort of got away with it, but it could have been an extraordinarily late finish.
Yeah, I mean, Matt's early finish tonight, it is midnight right now, and we've just started the podcast, so here we go. And as Catherine and Matt rightly said last night, I was dead to the night at about 10:30 and had a lovely lovely sleep.
Back on duty.
So it's my turn tonight. It's my turn, yeah, and I'm full of beans. I've had lots and lots to watch and enjoy over the course of today. So yeah, I'm giving Catherine the night off now. And I mean, it really has been a lot to watch today. It's been, but as you say, quite surprisingly. I mean, we'll start with the most recent match that we've just seen, which was Serbia beating Great Britain. And I think we were surprised. I think we were maybe, I don't know whether we over believed in Jack Draper's ability to kind of beat whoever Serbia put up at number two. I think maybe we did. I certainly think Miomir Kecmanović took me by surprise today. He was fantastic. I mean, we have seen that Miomir Kecmanović before. Last year at times, I mean, he had his best results and there were spells in that year when he was superb, but not. I thought Jack Draper played all right. I mean, there were some horror moments to produce double faults. There were, you know, maybe he could have done a bit more with his forehand more often, but he was playing hard, solid, aggressive, beefy tennis. And Kecmanović not only stood up to it, he actually had the point-ending power more often than his opponents. I mean, it was blooming impressive, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was really, really impressed with Kecmanović today. He was the better player against Draper. Draper didn't manage to get to deuce on the Kecmanović serve, whereas Kecmanović was very often in Jack Draper's service games. And, you know, Draper did a brilliant job to hold serve, I think, three games in a row in the second set from love 30, 15-30, 15-30, was constantly under pressure because of how well Kecmanović was playing. But ultimately, as you said, the difference was kind of two tie breaks, and Draper played a pretty poor first tie break with a couple of double faults, which you just can't afford to give top-level opponents that kind of advantage. And they both, I thought, played well in the second set tiebreak at times, and Draper in particular hit this incredible drop volley onto the line to, you know, to save match point at one stage in that tiebreak. And I thought, you know, the margins were so small, I thought it might swing in Draper's favour, and who knows what would have happened in a third set. But yeah, I thought Kecmanović on the whole was absolutely brilliant. The hitting from the baseline between them was just awesome at times. It felt like they both liked each other's ball in a way, and they were kind of able to sort of tee off and sort of produce some of their best stuff. But like you, I was kind of wrestling with that question of, did we slightly overrate Jack Draper? Do we generally slightly overrate Jack Draper? I don't think so. I am a big believer in his talent and in his potential. I think there's lots that he can still improve. I sort of noticed today he didn't really change the pace that much. I feel like developing a slice backhand would be quite a useful thing for him to be able to do. And I think maybe he can. But I think what I underestimated was the looming presence of Novak Djokovic in the second singles, because that was a must-win match for Jack Draper. Look, as much as anyone in the British team can say, I believe in Cameron Norrie, and, you know, everyone knew that Novak Djokovic was going to beat Cameron Norrie in the second singles. And I think Draper knew that as well. And he said he stepped onto the court kind of nervous. And I think Kecmanović was pretty free and able to play at a level that he hasn't really played at for most of this year. I mean, he's got a losing record on tour this year, Kecmanović. His eight most recent wins, other than one against Holger Rune, had all been against players ranked outside of the top 100. You know, he hasn't been producing this level repeatedly, but he's just seemed so confident. And I have to think that knowing that Novak Djokovic is following you and at the very worst is going to be in with a chance of winning it in the doubles must have just been a bit of a pressure release. And I think Draper in that environment for kind of the first time, really, that he was out there, really the tie was kind of on his shoulders. You know, he needed to deliver. And he said he felt pretty nervous and I thought he played well, but just in some slightly crucial moments, as you said, he just couldn't quite produce, and that was the difference. It was very small margins, but I do think that looming presence of Djokovic was still felt even in this first match when he wasn't on the court. It's kind of extraordinary the influence that he can have.
I'm interested to hear you say you felt he played well, Draper, because I felt that, and I said afterwards immediately, Draper played a good match. Kecmanovic played an excellent one, played a great one. He was really superb. He was the reason he won more than his opponent letting himself down was my take on it. I got a few replies saying Jack Draper hit 48 unforced errors. I did not see 48 unforced errors. Okay, I wasn't keeping count. I admit that. But it didn't feel like an unforced error strewn match to me. I think there's a difference in perception of what's forced and what's unforced, if that's the tally, by whoever's keeping count in this particular instance. My take was he was staying in an awful lot of rallies and playing and testing Kecmanovic, asking questions with deep shots, persistent long rallies. His opponent was just coming up with the answers time after time after time. That's my reading. And was his selection a surprise at the start of the day? I think we say Jera would be probably the expected pick. It certainly would have been mine.
Yeah, there was quite an interesting moment in Jack Draper's press conference, which I wanted to follow up on, but didn't get the chance. And he said that the team, so I take that to mean Leon Smith and all of the sort of backroom staff and maybe some of his fellow players as well, he said the team were expecting Jera to play, but Draper said that he was expecting Kecmanovic to play. So I found that interesting, and I wondered whether that did sort of just slightly affect the preparations at all. You know, I don't really know how much you target a specific opponent in your build up for a match like this, because it could have been any one of three, really. But Draper said that he's hit with Kecmanovic before and he really rates him. You know, he thinks that sort of ball striking level, he can be top 10 in the world, really. He just hasn't had the consistency over a full year to be able to get anywhere near that kind of ranking. So I was a bit surprised, but it does suggest that Draper wasn't, that Draper was ready for that challenge. They'd played earlier this year on clay. And again, Draper said that he felt like he had to play so well to beat him. So maybe something, even though Draper won that match, perhaps something just matchup-wise, the Serbians liked that. And maybe Kecmanovic felt he'd already got a feel for Draper's game, whereas Jera had never played Draper before. So they sent Kecmanovic out, and my goodness, he delivered. I thought he was brilliant, really, from start to finish. I was so impressed. His level didn't drop once. I think Draper could have returned better. Like, I don't think Kecmanovic has got an amazing serve. He served well for him, but to not get in any of those games, I think, would have been frustrating for Draper, not to push him to deuce, not to just apply some pressure. He was the one constantly under pressure. But yeah, so many of those rallies, they may have been ending on what someone may call an unforced error, but the ball was moving so quickly, and so often Draper was at the, you know, at the limit of his reach trying to hit a shot. And maybe sometimes his shot selection, he sometimes feels like he maybe goes for a bit too much sometimes, because he can pull it off. He can pull off the extraordinary. But maybe sometimes he needs to slightly rein it in when he's kind of at full stretch. But generally his rally tolerance is good. So I think it would be harsh to say that Draper played a bad match today. I was quite impressed, really, with both of them. But perhaps in the biggest moments, Draper didn't quite deliver.
I find that the whole thing fascinating. You said that the pace of Draper's shots is all quite similar. You know, that's one thing I've heard said by a couple of people. And you wonder whether the slice backhand might be an option. See, I wonder whether actually he needs to find another injection to be a bit more explosive. And whilst rally tolerance is a good thing and it keeps you in rallies, and they're not like weak shots by any means, but the guy with the injection of pace was down the other end more often, I felt. And I just thought, I almost want him to just tee off a couple on a couple of these and not get embroiled in a rally?
Well, that is kind of Draper's own analysis, I would say. He said that he's learning to play in the right way, and he described the right way as trying to use his size and use his power,
yeah,
and sort of
that's it,
impose himself and come forward. And he said he felt like he's getting a lot better at that, but he thinks that that's still an element that he can get better at. And look, I totally agree with that as well. I just think you kind of need a slice backhand or need a way of changing the pace in rallies. There are so few top players who don't have that. And I think, you know, or there are top players, but that's the reason that they have a bit of a ceiling, perhaps, that they don't quite have that variety. So I would like Draper to kind of develop that. But you're right. I think maybe first of all, working on imposing himself and taking over matches would sort of be the step that he's looking to make in 2024.
It was interesting. Catherine drew our attention while we were watching the match to something that commentators Nick Lester and Barry Cowan said about how Draper used to not be very big for his age when he was a junior, and therefore he was a bit of a scrapper from the baseline. And I think that still comes through in his DNA as a player, both for good and bad. It keeps him in rallies, but therefore maybe makes him retrieve a little bit too much or react. I think reacting is what he does a lot of the time, rather than being proactive and assertive and saying, no, you're going to get me now. I'm not going to respond to you. Mm. But anyway, we'll see how that develops. Not everybody can do that. I personally think Draper can. The next match that went out on the court was Novak Djokovic against Cameron Norrie. And look, everybody's got a chance in a match, and Norrie could have played the match of his life and Djokovic have a terrible day or get injured or something like that. I actually think Norrie played one of the best matches I've seen him play in quite a while. And he still got handily beaten in straight sets, 6-4, 6-4, by Novak Djokovic. I mean, there was nothing Norrie could do to change that scoreline the way it went, because I don't think he did much wrong. What did you think?
Yeah, look, there's just a gulf in class, isn't there? I mean, Cameron Norrie played well tonight and didn't really get that close. I think he only won more than one point on Djokovic's serve a couple of times in the entire match. Djokovic was just cruising through his service games. And I watched the second set from the media seats, which are pretty close to the court. And it's pretty rare that I get the chance to watch Novak Djokovic up that close. And I must say, I enjoyed it so much, just sort of put my phone away and just... I didn't really watch Cameron Norrie, to be honest. I basically just watched Novak Djokovic because, you know, sometimes I just think it's good to sort of appreciate what's in front of you like that. And what really struck me was the balance of him and how quickly he hits a shot and just immediately gets ready for the next one. And I know that sounds like a really simple, basic thing, but comparing him to all the other players, it's just something that he just seems to do better than everyone else. He just, the little bits of footwork and the little bits of getting himself in position for the next shot, he's just so sharp and focused. And therefore, that allows him time on the ball and it allows him to just be in position all the time and ready. And yeah, he just is never off balance. I don't know how you knock him off that. It's extraordinary. And I thought he played pretty within himself and pretty poised generally. Like, you know, we didn't see quite so much sort of explosion on the forehand side that maybe we saw quite a lot of in Turin. He was just pretty content to rally cross court. He was hitting some extraordinary angles with his forehand and then just sort of pull the trigger when he needed to or wait for Norrie to miss. He was very controlled the entire match. But then there was this big release of I don't know what you would call it, frustration, I think, really, at the British crowd at the end of the match. It was kind of an extraordinary moment.
Yes, because he hit an ace out wide and instantaneously turned to them with his arms out wide, his chest out, and a sort of "how do you like me now" sort of look on him, on his face, and he was clearly getting wound up by I think there was one in particular in the crowd who was giving him a hard time. And this, look, he's always been defiant, he's always been a better player when riled and when given a little cause like that. But it's something we've seen more and more of late, of him taking on a crowd and being unapologetic for it, and not trying to just sort of win every single person in the stadium over by being lovely. He's so much more comfortable being his authentic self, it seems to me now, and I love it. I actually think it's the best Novak Djokovic we've ever had, both in terms of his tennis and his kind of demeanor on the court. And frankly, I love that he gave it to them. I don't really have a problem with them giving it to him either. That's Davis Cup. And yeah, I know he didn't like it very much, but it all worked out, I think.
Did you see the encore interview?
I heard about it. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, because I completely agree with everything you've said. Like, during the match, it was sort of, I felt like it was pretty much fair game from those fans to be making the noise, you know, and I didn't feel like it crossed the line at all. But in the post-match interview, Novak Djokovic is speaking to the crowd, and the little contingent of the most vocal British support start drumming and start making a lot of noise so that Djokovic can't be heard. And
that's pretty rude.
I felt that was a bit rude, and people started to boo in the stadium because, you know, they wanted to hear what Novak Djokovic was saying. And the interviewer sort of took the microphone away. I think he was going to wait for them to stop, but then Novak Djokovic sort of leaned in and pretty emphatically told them to shut up. He told them to go home. He said, learn how to respect players. He sort of wagged his finger at them. He said, you're going to have a good sleep tonight. And yeah, he was really angry about the sort of lack of respect that they were showing him, not sort of allowing him to speak to the crowd. And I think it was that combined with one or two little things from the match that just sort of riled him up. And yeah, I thought he was well within his rights to say that, actually, at that point. I thought, you know, the match has been won, the teams have shaken hands, like, it's done. Let's hear from Novak Djokovic. It felt in slightly poor taste, I thought, from those fans, from what otherwise had been an amazing atmosphere, an amazing tie, and brilliant you know, contributions from the crowd. But yeah, it was a real release of frustration from Djokovic, who had more or less kept a lid on it. But yeah, he was not happy.
Great.
I enjoyed it.
We love all of that. Yeah, I mean, like I say, I do find that a bit rude. And, you know, the jousting and the all that's fun. But I'm just pleased he told them to get back in the box, to be honest. So that puts Serbia into the semifinals. We didn't get to see the doubles. They, in fact, decided not to play the doubles. No Neil Skupski and Joe Salisbury able to play rubber together, which, you know, look, as a British person, I would have liked to have seen that happen for obvious reasons, but also just from a competitive standpoint, it would have been fascinating, wouldn't it? You're always talking about wanting to see Novak Djokovic in doubles duty. Do you reckon they'd have put him and Kecmanovic together based on what you've seen today? I mean, that feels like a doubles partnership that might work.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, on the nominations, Djokovic was down with Lajovic, but
oh, right.
The nominations, you know, can very often change. And the fact that Kecmanovic played so well in that singles, and Djokovic obviously played well, and they don't have a sort of ready-made team, I can imagine that they would have gone back out together. And of course they played doubles the other week together in Paris, did Kecmanovic and Djokovic. Only one match, I think, but perhaps that was a little heads up that was the the doubles pairing that they're planning. I eagerly await a Novak Djokovic doubles decider this week. It's been an incredible week for doubles deciders already, but that is one that I am pretty desperate to see.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Well, that may well come against Italy, because Italy are going to be the opponents of Serbia in the semi-finals, and Italy today had to have a deciding rubber in the doubles because, yeah, it went 1-1 after the first two singles. It was Yannick Sinner who was doing double duty this time. He and Lorenzo Sonego beat Talon Griekspoor and Wesley Kulhoff 6-3, 6-3. That's interesting in itself, isn't it? That Kulhoff comes in, such a good doubles player, and can't turn that around in that match. So how do you assess what went on in that first tie of the day overall? Because we started with Botic van der Zandschulp beating Matteo Arnaldi 7-6 in the third, 9-7 third set tiebreak. And then Sinner beating Griekspoor 7-6, 6-1, and then 6-3, 6-3. For Sinner and Sonego in the doubles at the end.
Yeah, so that first match was about 3 hours long, and Botic van der Zandschulp saved three match points in that final set tie break to win it. And when he did win it, my thought was, okay, maybe the Netherlands are the favourites now, because suddenly you've got a freed up Talon Griekspoor to take on Yannick Sinner. You know, he's kind of got the pressure off him because Botic's already got a point for the Netherlands. All the pressure's on Sinner. And then even if it goes to the doubles, I felt like the Netherlands with, as you say, Wesley Kulhoff, were pretty well placed to win that. But from the moment Yannick Sinner took to the court, it was, in the words of Paul Harhaus, the Dutch captain, it was the Sinner show. I was so impressed with him today, and I think it's another example of the elevation that he's made, because I think it takes a special kind of player or personality to really take over a Davis Cup tie in the way that he did today. You know, we saw Leila Fernandez take over some Billie Jean King Cup ties just a couple of weeks ago, but she's a kind of give me the ball. I want to get out there and play sort of personality. And I've never really felt like that necessarily was Yannick Sinner. You know, he's pretty introverted, isn't he? But I think he has found a level and a sort of standard now that he expects of himself and that he knows he can bring. And I think his just sort of self-belief has gone up. Because I don't think 12 months ago he could have taken over a tie like this. And he just very calmly went about it and was so clearly the best player on that doubles court after winning the singles. He just took over it. I asked both Griekspoor and Kulhoff about this, and they were just so impressed with the way he was, first of all, serving. I mean, just rolling through his service games. That shot of his has got so much better in the last few months. He was in every return game because his return of serve is brilliant. And he barely missed a volley at the net. His anticipation up at the net was really good, and his hand skills were sort of on point when he needed them. He was just brilliant. And I think he settled Sonego down. Sonego was a bit sort of hyped up at the start and was maybe making a few errors, but he sort of looked over the other side and he was like, oh, okay, I'm fine. Sinner's got this. And that calmed Sonego down and made Sonego play better as well. It was a really impressive performance from Yannick Sinner in both the singles and the doubles. And again, Paul Harhouse came out with a fantastic line during the press conference. He was asked sort of where it went wrong for the Netherlands today. And he said it went wrong the moment Yannick Sinner landed in Malaga. And that really was the feeling. It felt like Griekspoor and Kulhoff kind of gave the best they could and they just ran into kind of the second best player in the world right now in terms of sort of current form. And he just stamped his authority on the tie in such an impressive way.
I never thought of Yannick Sinner as a doubles player. I didn't know he could.
Well, I don't think Yannick Sinner has really, to be honest, either. He said it was the best doubles he's ever played in his life today. And look, he's played a bit on the tour, hasn't he? He played with Sonego at the start of the year. He's played a bit with Alex de Minaur, but they've not. He's not won many matches at all. And yeah, it was surprising to me. I thought that was going to be a really, really close doubles, and it wasn't. Sinner in particular, and then Sonego towards the end, just wrestled it from the Dutch. Just took over.
That is a really fascinating tie coming up in the semi-finals, isn't it? Because they've beaten each other once each, Djokovic and Sinner. This feels different again because you know how much Djokovic wants to win this Davis Cup. You can see it in his eyes. You can see it in his celebrations with his team and how patriotic they feel right now. I mean, you know, they always are, but and all the teams are, but you can see it in Djokovic. He's ravenous for it. He wants this one, and he's missed out a couple of times in the Davis Cup, and I think he feels in just such an incredibly good place right now. He still seems fresh, even though it's nearly December. But whilst he is a better player than Yannick Sinner, he's a better player than everybody. Sinner is coming on strong and he's growing all the time. And maybe he'll be a little bit fresher himself now without the kind of, not that he looks like he's burdened in Turin, but there's no, it is different. You've got your team on your side. We don't know which Yannick Sinner is going to come out. And he may end up, he's most likely going to end up playing Djokovic twice, isn't he? I mean, what's his number two going to be like, do we think, against the Serbia number? Well, I mean, if Kecmanovic played like he did today, Serbia could do exactly what they did against Britain and not end up having to play a doubles.
Yeah, it's a bit of a game changer, isn't it? Kecmanovic playing so well. I sort of thought this is all going to be on Novak Djokovic, but Kecmanovic was awesome today. And I think that's a big call again for Vilandri, who plays number two. They had Arnaldi playing today.
Who I would have chosen today. I thought he got the selection right. And I mean, he's played an absolutely epic match. He's played brilliantly. But I mean, what sort of damage has that left to not win that match? I mean, that was his Davis Cup debut, wasn't it? And or at least at this level, the finals level.
Yeah.
And
he played in the group stages.
That's gotta hurt.
Yeah, he played in the group stages, which technically are the finals, but it's not the final eight. And he did play well at times. He made a bad decision on one of his match points. He sort of panicked and threw in a drop shot, and he wasn't playing the drop shot well. He was occasionally getting away with it, but he missed the drop shot wide on the match point. I think if Catherine had been in Arnaldi's press conference, she'd have come away from it thinking that he was a little bit too pleased, given he'd just lost. You know how we quite often have that conversation? Look, we don't...
I don't want to see him hurting.
Right, exactly. And we don't want players to be suffering, but we do want them, you know, to be hurting after losses, I suppose. It's a sort of juxtaposition that we sort of wrestle with. But he was so pleased with how he'd played. And that was quite sweet in a way. But I did just want to say, you lost, mate. Like, maybe don't be quite so pleased.
What you mean, like when I was interviewing a British player once in the early 2000s and he came in and I hadn't had a chance to see the results of the match. And it's one of those awful questions. Well, how do I ask the first question, given I don't know the result?
Oh, gosh.
And he looked delighted. So I think I just about managed to keep it generic enough not to say, well, you must be delighted with the way things have gone. You know, I think I kept it generic and just said, so tell me about the match. Mm. And he goes, yeah, well, it was disappointing, obviously. I'm thinking, why have you got a massive smile on your face then? You look really thrilled. Anyway.
Yeah, it was, look, I get why he was pleased because, yeah, he did play pretty well at times. And it was a big moment for him to even be chosen, I suppose. It was one of those slightly awkward press conferences where the Cinemax had already started, and quite often they will turn off the screens once the press conference starts, but they don't do that here. So constantly Arnaldi is distracted by looking over at what's going on in the Cinemax, which I kind of loved. You know, I love watching tennis players watch tennis. I spent much of the GB Serbia tie watching Dan Evans as a fan in the crowd, and that was highly entertaining in itself. As he,
what was he like?
Well, look, I don't know how many drinks he'd had, but it gradually seemed like he'd had more and more as the night went on. He was, you know, he was sitting there pretty intently watching to begin with, and by the end he was up and joining in the chants and with his bucket hat in his hand, swirling it around and sometimes wearing it, and you know, he was a fan, he was a genuine fan. It was kind of amazing to see that. But anyway, back to Italy. I do think they've got a big selection to make there in the number two singles, because do you put Arnaldi back out? Maybe. Sonego, I think, is kind of made for Davis Cup, you know, the way that he responds to crowds. But again, he can be inconsistent. Like, you might get some magic, but you might get a disaster with him. And Mozzetti.
You wanted him today, didn't you?
I did.
Your call was him today. I remember listening to the show that you and Catherine did this morning, and I was thinking, no, I'd be going on Aldi. Well, that almost worked, but not quite. So I think you've got to go Sonego now if he's fit.
But what I would say is Sonego and Sinner did combine really well in the doubles, and you know, do you want that as your doubles pairing? Can you afford to even be thinking about the doubles? Do you need to try and get it done in the singles? I don't know. There's so much at play. It's what I find so fascinating about Davis Cup and Davis Cup team selection. There is, of course, Lorenzo Mozzetti as well. I don't know what it says about Lorenzo Musetti that he went with Arnaldi today. Like, I think it probably says that he maybe feels the same we do, that there's a kind of bit of a flakiness there. He's just not the guy you trust, especially on a surface other than clay. I think if this were clay, you would maybe go with Musetti just because of his quality. But yeah, there's something lacking in kind of all of those singles options. So it's going to be very, very interesting, because it's not like today where even if they lose that first singles, they know that Sinner's likely to win the second one. You know, Sinner's not going to be the favourite against Djokovic. He might win. If anyone here can beat Djokovic, it's Sinner. But I think we still have to bat Djokovic. He's now won 21 matches in a row in the Davis Cup, and he's so desperate to win this for Serbia. So it's fascinating. I do feel like Italy kind of need to win that second singles. So who they go with, I don't know. But I just feel like Sonego gives you the chance of peaking, you know, and a peaking Sonego is a pretty dangerous prospect.
Okay, well, it's a few minutes later, actually, that we're speaking now, because I've just had a power cut in Solihull. It's our second one in 2 hours. The first one went on for about 45 minutes. This one just took me out mid-chat, Matt, so I'm sure you were making a splendid point. You were midway talking about Lorenzo Sonego. I missed the end bit.
Yeah, I thought you just had sort of given up on me and thought he is talking rubbish about Lorenzo Sonego. I think I said something along the lines of, you've got a chance that he can peak Sonego. And I feel like you might need that, because yeah, they need to win that second singles, because you can't bank on beating Novak Djokovic, I don't think, even with
probably best not to. You know, something you and Catherine were talking about while I was driving this morning and listening, and it was really interesting hearing you talk about Finland and the Ruusuvuori of it all, and whether you choose him even if he's sort of 4% fit, just so that you can make sure that Virtanen gets to play against not Alex Dim at all. and I was listening to that, and it did make me think, Is that a real flaw of this format of only having three rubbers in a tie of this importance? That if you just sort of calculate who you don't want to play against somebody, and then that can be just a tie difference maker in one go, is that right? Should that be happening? You know, if when you used to have five rubbers to decide a tie, best of five. Look, I think it's probably fair enough, in my view, not to have best of five sets anymore for the sheer length of it all. But does that need to be looked at? You know, is that going too far down the sort of strategic route? I.e., if you've got five rubbers, it sort of reduces the ability to influence things quite so dramatically with a selection.
I think Heinz Günthart would agree with you, because that was very much the issue back then, wasn't it? The way the Russian Tennis Federation sort of manipulated their lineup to try and get the matchup they wanted against the Swiss a couple of years ago in the Billie Jean King Cup. That was all to do, though, with changing at the last minute. This is slightly different. I think this is such an extreme example that actually it's not that much of a problem. I don't think there are many teams who are saying, well, we're going to put out our injured player in order to get the matchup that we want, because most teams have less of a discrepancy between their top player and their number two, or their number two and their number three in this case. Like, it's just such a big deal for Finland because, you know, Patrick Kaukovalta is just not anywhere near the level of Otto Virtanen or Emil Ruusuvuori. So I think if you were to sort of radically overhaul that system that's currently in place, you'd be trying to fix a problem that doesn't really exist. Like, I think it's popped up here, but we've never really talked about it before. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I do know what you mean. And by the way, Paddy K, I believe in you. So don't you be listening to Catherine and Matt slagging you off.
Well, what I should say is there were positive reports in the Finnish press today about Emil Ruusuvuori. I think he's going to play.
I think so too. So Finland, Australia tomorrow for a place in the Davis Cup final. What do you think? Who do you think's going to win?
I do think Australia are going to win. I think they're the favourite in every match, you know. So I think Finland would have to sort of flip two matches, which seems, you know, possible but unlikely. Like I said, I think Ruusuvuori is going to play, but whether he's ready to beat Alex de Minaur feels unlikely. So Finland are relying on Otto Virtanen again. And I think Australia's selection there is interesting. Does he stick with Jordan Thompson? Does he go with Alexi Popperin? Does he go with Max Purcell? Who knows? I mean, there's a few options there for Hewitt. But yeah, basically, I feel like Finland are in a similar place tomorrow to what Britain were in tonight. You know, that trying to win that first singles, that number two singles, is just vital because of the unknowns over Ruusuvuori's fitness and because of how good Alex de Minaur is. So I think it's just another big day for Otto Virtanen. I have to think that the Aussies will pull it out, but I would love nothing against the Aussie number two. I would love Otto Virtanen to win that opening singles because we're expecting big Finnish support again, and then a free swinging Ruusuvuori giving it a go against Alex de Minaur. That sounds fun.
He's talented, isn't he? He's
very talented. And then even if he doesn't do it, a doubles decider. You know, Finland being one match away from the Davis Cup final would be extraordinary. So I'm hoping for another fun day, but I do think the Aussies will ultimately get through.
Oh, it's all too exciting. So all this takes place at 4 o'clock local time for you tomorrow, doesn't it? There's no 10 a.m. start, so Matt can have a bit of a lie-in in the morning, thankfully. And, so 3 p.m. in the UK. And, yeah, it will be absolutely fascinating. And then it all starts earlier, doesn't it, on Saturday with a 10 o'clock start for you. No, is it 12? No, it's 12 o'clock.
Yeah, midday.
12 o'clock local time. That's it. That's for Serbia against Italy. Oh, I just can't wait. It's going to be fantastic. Really enjoyed it today, Matt. Really enjoyed your reports on what you've been seeing and hearing and doing. Anything else to add before I send you off to bed?
Only that I think we've been pronouncing Talon Griekspoor wrong. And I can't...
Oh, great.
I know. I can't pronounce it, but... Bortik van der Zandschulp said it, and I knew that we were getting it wrong. Basically, that sound we make at the end of van der Zandschulp, you need to make it kind of the start of Griekspoor. It's just a very difficult thing to do.
Oh, we haven't got Catherine.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. So that's one for Catherine. It's not a hard G at the start. It's not a Griekspoor. It's a slightly different sound.
Griekspoor.
Yeah. Very good. I would say it's a bit like that.
Okay. I don't want to say that. Okay. I can only just about say Griekspoor. Anyway, we'll see how we get on with that in the years to come when we have to pronounce his name. He'll become one of those players that we hope doesn't do well, yeah. So we don't have to say his name very
the
often.
The Dutch number
really
one.
Is not satisfactory, is it? No. Come on, tennis podcast, no. You can do better than that.
I think Griekspoor's fine, but if we want to be nailing it, and I know Catherine likes to nail her Dutch pronunciations, I'd say there's work for us to do.
You just know that about 4 seconds after hearing this section of the podcast, she's going to record it on a voice note and send it to us,
so.
As it's supposed to be. Right. Well, good night, Catherine. hope you have a good sleep, and we'll perhaps have you back with us tomorrow. Certainly will over some point over the next couple of days. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you for joining us. We have also to thank our mascots, me, Maisie, Catherine's Xenia, Matt's Darwin, Billie Jean the dog is thankful to Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. Our top folks and executive producers are people we are thankful for every single time that we do a show in 2023, because Jamie, Hannah and Drew have been with us every single step of the way. And yeah, no shout outs today because we want to do it as a team. So it does mean that we may have a few shout outs left at the end of the year, which don't worry, you will get your shout outs. If you've paid for one, you'll be getting one, but you'll be getting one with the full team, even if we have to just spill over into the new year. Although we do have a few podcasts planned for December, so you never know, but we might squeeze them in then. Matt, go to bed, I think is the best course of action before I have another power cut. So yeah. Thanks for being with us today. We'll speak to you tomorrow.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.